Hello and welcome to episode number 349 of the Super Horror Bros podcast. I'm your host Matt, and joining me as always is my brother Mike.
Hello.
How's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good.
We are back with a much anticipated show, one that we've been looking forward to for a very long time now. Pretty much since started doing this, you know, and we've been doing this retrospective for years at this point. And this was always one that, whilst we knew it was always going to be right towards the end, it was one that we were very excited for.
Yeah, and I think especially then when we knew we were going to get a nice 4K version, so we had a nice way to watch it as well.
Yeah, perfect synergy that was for the, of course, the brand new 4K release this year of Red Eye. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we will get into it shortly, and we'll actually get into it very quickly because there is no news this week. Literally nothing.
Mate, I'm not prepared for the news yet. I don't know what to do anymore. Like, I'm not prepared. I normally get to like just chill for 20 minutes.
Exactly. Like, I mean, I can just pull up like the Black Mirror episode times again if you want.
No, I'm good.
But yeah, there was like a couple of things I put on the docket, and I was like, these are terrible. So
yeah, I mean, your bar is like fairly low for these things as well. It's like, has Rob Zombie tweeted in the last week? No. Okay.
I mean, there's literally news about the Winnie the Pooh sequel, and I was like, I'm not doing it. So exactly.
Go on.
It's deleted now. I've just forgotten what it was. So
any update on the Peter Jackson Brain Dead?
No. I need to look for that actually.
Yeah, because I really want that.
Definitely. But yeah, no, we're just going to get straight into it. It gives us more time. These episodes are usually longer anyway, because there's so much to talk about with these retrospectives, kind of the history of the movies as well as our feelings. And then obviously we go into the definitive ranking afterwards. So yeah, let's talk about Red Eye. So yeah, this is, I guess, in our list, it's the penultimate. Obviously, Wes did two movies after this, but we've already covered his final movie, Scream 4. And yeah, one that it's so difficult to even begin to talk about and not inject like thoughts and feelings into it straight away.
I mean, let's inject some feelings. Like, do you have a recollection of like when you first saw this movie or heard of this movie? Then go on. Lay on me.
I remember the exact day that we both watched this. Which was so it's interesting because on Wikipedia it came out in August.
It's called a softball, by the way. But yeah, go on.
Don't let them know how the sausage is made. That's like the best segue you've done in 7 years. But yeah, obviously this it apparently came out in August, but I think it was like September 1st or September 2nd in the UK. We saw it on September 4th, 2005, at the cinema, which, yeah, it was fairly novel at the time. Like, I think back to this era of kind of seeing, like, me and you specifically going to the cinema, and even more specifically watching horror films. Resident Evil is the one that always stands out to me, 'cause I think that was 2002. Which is mind-blowing that I went to that. I was 12 years old when that movie came out.
You were not old enough to see that movie when we went to see it.
No, not at all. Like, I had a whole routine, which I think I've gone over on the show. I don't think I needed to do it for Red Eye.
No.
Because, yeah, the Blu-ray says a 12, the 4K says a 12. I don't know if that's what it was at the time.
I think it was.
Yeah, I can't imagine this would have been a 15, but it's really hard to say. But yeah, like I say, those early horror, you know, big screen times, like Resident Evil was a big one. I saw Hostel as well, which that's the craziest one, because Resident Evil was a 15, which I snuck into. But Hostel 2004, I think. I'm just going to double check now, because I saw that at the cinema. I was nowhere near 18. that was 2005 as well, so that was the same year as this. So yeah, that was a really fun year. Like, I remember that was right at the start of the year. But Yeah, so I remember these. Like, these were like those really sort of formative movies for me. Yeah. And seeing them on the big screen, obviously watching a lot. And we've gone in depth about, you know, Hills of Eyes Part 2 and those ones of watching at home. But I think that's why Red Eye and Hostel and Resident Evil are these movies that I saw on the big screen. I just have so much nostalgia for. Like, those specifically, those three films. I'm struggling to think now if there's any more of that ilk at that time. But I'll always remember seeing those three at the big screen.
Yeah, I mean, Resident Evil was huge, for sure. Yeah. This one was a weird one where I think, like, you know, I think it was, I don't know whether it was specifically Wes Craven at this point or whether it was just we saw the trailer and kind of...
I think it was Wes, you know. Like, I don't think I'm misremembering that. I feel like it was both of us being like, okay, we know this isn't a horror, but we know it's Wes, so we wanted to see it just because of that.
Yeah, you know, and just, I just remember being like, you know, this was one that, you know, not when we had a podcast to talk about or when, you know, we thought we'd be trying to actively champion movies, but this was just one that I felt the need to try to get people to see. You know, if people were like, oh, have you seen anything good lately? You know, it'd be like, oh yeah, you got to go see this movie. Like, this, just don't know anything about it. It's just a fun little, you know, just simple journey. You know, and I think even looking back now, this movie just screams like Wes Craven. Like, watching it, and there's so much about it that's just his DNA and his way of filmmaking that comes through. And it's like, there are so many scenes in this movie that could just be ripped straight from a Scream movie. And it's almost like he had like a load of ideas and sequences and things where the killer was unmasked, and he was like, oh, okay, I need the killer's face, but that doesn't happen in a Scream movie, and just like put them in this little contained, you know, fun little story.
Yeah, I remember like watching this finale for the first time in the cinema, and obviously at that time we'd just seen the Scream trilogy at home. And so seeing this on the big screen, I was like, oh shit, we're getting like a mini Scream film on the big screen, which was fantastic at the time for sure. But yeah, obviously this came out in 2005. I guess, what was the, was it Vampire in Brooklyn, or did we do one after that? Let's have a look. It was Cursed. So Cursed, wow, was that really? Yeah, apparently Cursed came out earlier in 2005. Yeah, so, and again, I don't know when we got that, because, like, yeah, we watched Cursed on DVD for sure.
Yeah.
So that's a weird one. Like, God, that's so bizarre to me that these two movies, especially with how long, I mean, we obviously talked about that a lot in the last episode, like how long Cursed took. This was a lot more of a smoother production.
Yeah, I think that was why he was like, I just need to make a movie, man. Like,
And it's so goddamn refreshing as well, because it's been unfortunate going through this retrospective, and you have the big heavy hitters that, like, you're not really bringing anything new to the table. Like, everyone, in terms of discussing them these days, everyone knows the classics of Wes Craven. And I think with the rest of his filmography, there are these, you know, little hidden gems and kind of other ones that people gravitate towards. But I think the consistent theme was always studio interference. It was the ratings board just ripping it to shreds, and it was just like these long drawn out, like a lot of production hells would be how I describe them. And to see Red Eye be so smooth, have no issues, but then also, and another thing as well, is they would either be mixed reviews or they would be box office bombs a lot of the times. Whereas looking at this now, it's like this movie had overwhelmingly positive reviews from critics at the time. It was a budget of $26 million, and it made $96 million at the box office, which, like, is really incredible, especially in 2005, and especially considering a lot of Wes's movies around that time weren't making that sort of money. I just want to have a direct comparison now to Cursed. Yeah, I mean, Cursed made like 25 to 29, it says, at the box office on a budget that was close to 100 million. So, like, it's the complete inverse.
Whoa, hold on, that was 100 million pound budget.
Yeah, apparently it's somewhere between plus 75 to maybe 90 to 100, because obviously they shot like four different films, remember?
Yeah, I guess.
4 years. So it was absurd how fucked they got that movie. But I love, obviously, we'll get into the actual film, but I'm just so happy to see this go so well, you know, from an outside perspective.
It felt like he just, got to make a movie that, just didn't have any other shit going on, which was, just nice.
Yeah, like, I wish we lived in the world where this was the norm for him as a creator and as a great artist, because this is what he deserves. When you look at what he did in the 80s to now get this in 2005, this should have been what it should have been. He should have been rattling out a movie every 3 or 4 years and it just be smooth, because he's Wes Craven. And, like, it's a shame that it wasn't that way for multitude of different reasons, that he would always get these dodgy projects. And I'm really happy Red Eye exists, not only because I love the film, but I'm really happy that he got this big win towards the end of his career.
And even like, to get someone like Cillian Murphy at that time, he was like taking off, and like, this movie came out the same year that he was in Batman Begins.
Right.
and he was, really, kind of this hot ticket, after 28 Days Later, but this is a few years after that, and this is really when the roles seem to be coming in for him. And like I said, this came out, I don't know when Batman Begins came out that year, but it feels like, this movie just kind of came out and it was like, oh yeah, that guy that's in that giant superhero movie, he's also in this. And like, it just worked perfect for that as well, the fact that he could, ride that coattail and probably get more revenue off it. And it's like, Wes getting a win with like those, all of those things just doesn't happen in the rest of this filmography.
Yeah, definitely. Batman Begins was in the summer, so it was like just before this. Yeah, and you're like absolutely right. Yeah, like he broke out in 28 Days Later, and then he was kind of doing mostly British stuff. So this was very much the transition to the rest of the world, I would say. It was like him being in, obviously, Batman and doing this movie. And then it's like, okay, now Cillian Murphy can do any type of film. He's not just going to be in British or Irish like productions forever. Obviously, he's gone on to have it in...
tethered to a British and Irish production for the last decade.
Yeah, but it's different, isn't it?
Like, he's made some bang.
Yeah, I mean, he was in a pretty big movie that we saw not too long ago, lest we forget. So, but yeah, Red Eye.
Coming up as well.
He is indeed. He's always in good shit. Like, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned him right off the bat, because he's a guy who we're clearly a big fan of, and he's been in so much. But I don't know about you, but my mind has never, for once in the last 18 years, ever associated him with anything more than Red Eye. It's crazy, because obviously he's in 28 Days Later, and I get that. But for me personally, he'll always be the guy in Red Eye.
Yeah, I think it was just because you got to see that level of charm that he's got. And it was like, it was this perfect thing where it was like, his career, he could have been like the next Hugh Grant or something and just been this heartthrob. But he got cast in these roles very early on with, with Red Eye and even, Batman, where he is this charming character that's a villain. And suddenly he had this whole career of being this charming villain. And I'm like, oh, hell yes, that's what I want, like, from it. And I don't, someone that's watched all of Peaky Blinders and really only watched that because he was in it, like, was the main selling point for me early on. And even now, I'm like, it's Jack Reppner. It's just so fantastic. And, I guess, should we actually do a synopsis and then go into some thoughts on the movie?
Give us a quick synopsis. It's a pretty easy movie to kind of set up.
Yeah, but obviously the other lead is Rachel McAdams, who's also awesome.
Yeah.
And in a ton of stuff. And whenever I see her, I'm also like, I wouldn't remember that her name's Lisa all the time, but I'd be like, oh, it's her from Red Eye.
Yeah, that's because like, everyone else that I speak to when they see it is like, she's like, oh, what, the girl from Mean Girls? Whereas for me, it's the lead from Red Eye.
Definitely. She plays Lisa, who's this kind of manager of a hotel who is catching the Red Eye flight back to Miami to get back to hotel. And she meets the aforementioned Cillian Murphy, Jack Reppner, in the airport, kind of whilst their flight has been delayed. And, they end up having a drink at the bar, and he is just this super charming kind of guy that's trying to get her drink and all of these different things. And she then gets on the flight, and lo and behold, who is she sat next to but Mr. Jack. And very quickly, and as I remember this with the movie when I watched it the first time, you know, this movie doesn't fuck around. It's a short movie, and the charm pretty much just gets eliminated very quickly. You know, as soon as the turbulence ends and the flight, the airplane is in the air, she's like, "What do you do for a living?" And he's straight away, and he's like, "Well, actually, you're what I do for a living right now." And just turns instantly and reveals that he is some sort of, you know, he's not a gangster, he's not a hitman, but he is some sort of gun for hire or person for hire, because he is a shit shot apparently, who gets things done in the criminal underworld. And he wants to use Lisa to move a high profile politician to a room that is more accessible for a hit that's going to take place. And he's kind of using her dad as a blackmail, and have a guy that's like stalking her dad, that if she doesn't do what he asks, her dad dies. And the rest of the movie is really the cat and mouse tension between these two on the plane. And there's not a wasted moment on the plane. There's not a wasted moment in the movie, but on the plane, and it's one of them where, like, as I was rewatching this movie, as they're getting on the plane, and you see the two fucking dudes with the pen, and you see the old lady with the book and the little girl going on the flight, and I'm just like remembering all of these people, and it just reminds me of, you know, just excited to see like their little moments, and it's so well orchestrated, because they all get their little moment going on the plane, and then they get a moment throughout the movie. And you know, whether it's the flight attendants and they're kind of, you know, being friendly with them to start with, to when they think that they've tried to join the Mile High Club, and the way she walks up to him and just like trash. Like is fantastic. Like I say, the old lady, everything with her, and I just don't think they miss a second. And it's so hard to look past the two leads because they're perfect. But the ensemble cast that are just in it in these little moments also nail everything, and it's so fucking good. I think something like this could feel, you know, you could get taken out of it, I think, quite easily, and because it's quite, you know, it should be quite grounded, and I think it could easily feel not real and be like, come on, like, you must be able to get out of this or whatever. But every little plan that she tries to do is kind of perfectly, you know, answered for. And even just little things like the fact that it is this red eye flight, and so 90% of the people on the flight are just trying to sleep, so you can get away with a little bit more, you know. The headbutt to knock her out is a little bit over the top, but to be fair, it's not like this crazy active flight. Everyone around him is almost asleep or just focused on reading or writing or watching the movie or whatever. And I think that's what really attracted me to this movie early on, is that like Wes was able to create this feeling like you're doing a Scream movie when you're in your home alone on a fucking aeroplane full of people. And it was like, how can she feel trapped and isolated on an aeroplane full of people? And he 100% did that with this movie. And I think that's the thing that really, you know, the first time we watched this, you know, 18 years ago, was the thing that landed with me, where I was like, man, this guy really is next level. And it was, and I think it was that moment in our lives, really, where we were like, oh shit, like, we like a lot of Wes Craven stuff. We've then just gone to see this movie on a whim because it's Wes Craven, and this guy's a fucking genius. And I really do think that, yeah, that obviously there are movies that we talk about, and you know, his filmography that speaks for itself. But I think this movie for us was the one that kind of glued it all together, where we were like, yeah, we will just see anything that this man puts out, and he really is a genius. And like I said, him being able to give you that feeling of on a plane, of being absolutely isolated and alone, I thought was great.
Yeah.
So many different things with, you know, the telephones not working, and then they're working, and her playing the game, and just yeah, like I say, everything on the plane to me is just perfection. The movie just doesn't. There's not a second of the movie where I'm not entertained, which is just so rare, you know.
Mm. Yeah, we talk a lot about runtimes, like, nowadays, obviously, on the podcast. But, like, movies like this are almost unfair. It really, like, it's mind-blowing that from the start of this movie to the second the credits hit, it's 77 minutes, which is ridiculous. For how much plot there is, how much character development there is, how much action there is, how much tension there is, how much drama there is, it's... And how unbelievably satisfying the whole thing is. It's really, like, shameful on so many films that they have. To me, it always comes back to the same thing. I think a lot of movies, unfortunately, and the people making those movies have a lot of ego involved. Yeah. And I think someone like Wes has never had that problem, clearly. He so easily could have been a guy who had an ego when you look at what he's done in the genre. And he could have wanted to stretch out something like this. And he could have wanted to have, oh, I'm going to have this extra side plot because that's going to give me more budget and therefore more money and a bigger film and all this stuff. And it's like, no, I want this to be a self-contained, short narrative that is mostly a single character study. Most of this film is just telling Lisa's story, and it's everyone else is just a side character within that. It really is through her lens. You know, we are Lisa watching this film, and that is such a remarkable feat, I think, as a director. And I definitely want to get into the guy who wrote this movie as well, because I think it's such a masterclass in creating such a tight thriller, which, again, I feel like it's just been left these days. Like, obviously, I like so many modern films, but, like, the amount of films I've seen where I'm like, oh, that was awesome, but why was there, you know, I haven't rewatched The Batman, because, and I really love that film at the cinema. Yeah, but there's 45 minutes genuinely in the middle of that movie, like the whole Catwoman subplot, where I'm like, I didn't remember anything that I enjoyed in that entire section of the movie. To the point that it's just completely put me off it from all the awesome shit, the way it starts and how sick the Riddler is and stuff. And, like, it's annoying because that is unfortunately not the outlier. I can think of so many movies that are just like that, where I'm like, oh man, this did so many exceptional things, but why was it so drawn out? And why did it feel like it had to have so much content? And I feel like with this film, it's so clever in that, like, it kind of gives you these little pieces of who Lisa is, and we learn more about what she's been through recently and kind of who she is as a person. But other films would want to show all that. You know, we'd have like a 20-minute flashback sequence. They'd want to drag out the bit on the
opening of the movie.
Yeah, well, yeah, they could do that. Yeah, definitely. Or, like, because they want the plane stuff to go on even longer, we would constantly be leaving the confines of the plane through flashbacks, which would completely ruin the flow of it. Like, the fact that it is almost in real time, this whole film, I think is another one of the best selling points of it, that it... Obviously, it's not in real time because it's like an overnight flight, but, like...
It's real time for Lisa while she's conscious,
pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. You're absolutely right, yeah, because that's what's weird about it. Like, it does feel real time, even though it shouldn't be, because obviously it's a... You know, there's a plane ride and stuff. But yeah, there's just like a tightness to this execution that is remarkable. And I always wondered, because I've wanted to rewatch this one for a while. Obviously, I have such fond memories of it, and knowing that we were going to do it for the podcast, I've been waiting for a few years, and then obviously with this brand new 4K, which we can get into our thoughts on the release as well. But, like, I always wondered, had I put this movie too much on a pedestal? Mm. And was it purely just nostalgia? And I look at it now through like as much of a critical lens, even though that's not the point of this at all, because we're just talking about this from purely a fan perspective. But like, I don't see any faults with this film whatsoever. And I think it's even more remarkable by today's standards in comparison to so many movies that can't live up to this sort of stuff. Like, it really does bother me, especially thrillers. Like, this type of thriller, I do feel like the early 2000s was a pretty banger period for this type of film, because I feel like that has gone away through streaming and through like the wanting to keep a level of engagement, wanting to give people this like quote unquote value for money. So everything's too long nowadays. Everything on Netflix is too long. You know, every TV show for the most part's too long unless it's on HBO. Like, there really is this lack of a respect for your time, I feel like, in today's entertainment. And throwing a movie on like this, like, think about it on like a pound for pound scale. Like, I struggle to think about any movie that will provide me with as much entertainment and as much satisfaction in 77 minutes than Red Eye. Like, from that perspective, it's crazy. Mm.
And as well, like you said, you know, like, I find it difficult to, you know, watch longer movies because I don't have a lot of free time. And the amount of times that I do have to watch a movie for the podcast in multiple sittings, not always through choice, but just because I don't have that level of free time that I can, like, carve out. And, like, but with this one, it was like, yeah, I know I can just put it on and I can get the full experience. And that means... that helps my enjoyment level, the fact I get to watch it in one go. And I know that's a very me problem, but I think it...
No, that's definitely an issue that a lot of people have.
Well, yeah, I know, but I mean, like, you know, it's people that are making the, you know, the art shouldn't necessarily be worried about that. But I think there is this just overwhelming want for things to be super long. And it is like, you know, I've just started watching... Midnight Mass again, and every episode is like over an hour, and like I want to rewatch Lord of the Rings TV show, and I was like, Christ, how long is that? And it's like, yeah, there are exceptions where it's worth it to be that long, but then you've really got to struggle to fit that good shit in as well. Like, how much I love Lord of the Rings, but I'm like, man, that's a commitment to rewatch that series. You know, but stick Red Eye on and you're good.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, yeah, from an artistic standpoint, obviously the people that make and stuff shouldn't worry about that. Ooh. But the reality is that everyone is competing with everyone's time right now. We're at an all-time high for just things to do. And it's whether it's obviously we're like massively into video games, so that kind of takes a chunk of the time as well. But like, even if you're not, even if you're someone that only watches films, that in itself is ridiculous. Even if, and then if you want to, I feel like it's almost impossible these days to just be a film fan. You know, I would always consider myself a film fan first, but like the rise of TV in the last decade, I think, is undeniable at this point. That like, if you're still choosing to just watch film, like, I respect it, and you're going to get, I still think, an amazing, worthwhile experience. But there's so much good TV now, in a way that there wasn't when this film came out, for example. You know, there wasn't an amazing amount of unbelievable TV shows with the best actors in the world in 2005. There just wasn't. Whereas nowadays, there will be multiple just on HBO this year, you know, let alone everywhere else, let alone Netflix and Amazon and all these other things.
And it was just Lost, mate.
Exactly. And they really did change the game. But like,
and 24, if you liked it.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned, because I was going to bring up 24, because I think this movie is... it's a crazy how much a reaction to 24 I thought this film was, rewatching it now. And that's a lens that, or an opinion that I never had until this current rewatch, where I was like, holy shit. Like, it, you forget that 24 was like the Game of Thrones of its time, where it was the biggest show in the world.
And 24 was so fucking good as well. Like, yeah, it really was. Amazing,
for sure. Yeah. But like my memories of 24 is like, 90% of scenes, someone is either on a phone or on a computer. That's like 90% of that show. And it was because of this obsession with the new tech at the time in the early 2000s, when obviously we didn't have the tech we had now, but like, we really thought we were sophisticated then. We had phones that weren't bricks anymore, obviously, before like the reinvention of the smartphone, but we had decent phones and we had decent computers, and it felt like unbelievably futuristic. And so when you're watching 24 and people are running, they're on small cellular phones, someone's on a computer, they're able to pull up, you know, the exact GPS coordinates of where someone is, like, that felt like so futuristic at the time. And I just love how much of a time and place 24 was, and its fingerprints are all over Red Eye, which I really love.
Man, I'd love to watch 24 again.
Yeah, I would, but my problem is I've rewatched season one like 4 times, and then I've never watched the rest. It's so embarrassing. Like, it just, it's always happened that way, and it's unfortunate, but I really like season one. It's a banger.
Have you never seen past season one then?
I think I've watched some of season two, but I've definitely not watched past like that. But and I've seen season one at least 3 or 4 times. Like, I can take most of what happens.
Crazy.
Yeah.
It did overstay its welcome, but it was a great show. But I think, like you say, you put like Alicia Cuthbert in the position of, you know, being there, Jack Rippner, and then you have Jack Bauer, you know, just like trying to stop the assassination at the same time. This could easily be like a 3-hour window in 24 for sure.
Definitely. The whole subplot of like a family and a take, you know, an assassination take, it really was like crazy. And obviously the constant phone calls as well was what really made me think of 24.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think though, like you mentioned, how this is very much Lisa's lens, and I get that, but I think like so many of the side plots and side characters are really endearing and work, and you know, just don't they could be complete throwaway, because even the family, you know, the politician's family and him, you know, like he could have just been a face that you see at the end of the movie, but the fact that we get these in a short ass movie, these just little snippets of him and his family, and to show that he is like this politician that's busy, but he is a family man, and just taking his time to like smile at his wife and stuff. And you're like, kids, I don't want him to die. Like, that one scene was enough to be like, I don't want this guy to die, you know. But if he was just like an unnamed politician that's just done this speech that's riled people up, would I have that want for him to survive as much? Because I not only did I want Lisa to be okay, I did want her to save him as well.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought that was great. I thought her dad was fantastic. You know, he just like, again, from the voicemail or from the phone call she had with him, to then her telling Jack about him, to then seeing him do that shit and like, you know, go watching the comedy marathon and stuff. It was just like, I felt like I knew him more than I did.
Yeah,
and that's what this movie does with every character, and Cynthia is amazing as well, you know. And again, like this short ass movie, and we've got her having these interactions with the with that couple who complain about the room, and Lisa sorts it out on the phone to Cynthia, and then like they come back at the end of the movie for the kicker, and it was just like, this feels like a 3-hour movie with the amount of content we've got in there. Like, all of these goddamn side plots, it's insane that they managed to fit all of that in. And it is just because it's like bang, bang, bang. You know, you think in that first 10 minutes, you get set up with Cynthia, you get the set up with her dad, and you get loads of Lisa and Jack, and then suddenly they're on a plane, and then Jack heel turns instantly. It's like, man, that's just, it just goes like. And rewatching it, there were just so many little bits that I appreciated, because like, the, you know, we talk a lot about the opening scene and in movies and how unnecessary they are. And like this one, like when you first watch it, it feels like such an unnecessary, stupid scene of just like a pan in camera and then just a hand stealing a wallet. And then the way it's brought back into the movie and how that's his initials as well. And, you know, just, there's just so many things that I'm just like sat there, like just kind of just like clapping, doing a little silent clap, like just from the script to the execution, to the actors' performances, you know, it really is great. And I think, you know, when she orders the fucking Baybreeze at the start of the movie and like, you know, knowing what he says later on in the movie, I'm just like chuckling away to myself. But it's the way that she says it, and it's the way that she doesn't want to empower him in this game. And it's such a defining kind of character kind of moment for her that you wouldn't realize watching it the first time. And then you watch it again and you're like, yeah, she is trying to be this strong, independent woman that isn't going to let a man get her drink after what happened to her. And yeah, I just think all of those things are just so great. And even the whole reveal of what happened to her, you know, that could have easily been just a flashback or a throwaway thing, but it was such a pivotal point in the movie that she decided to tell him that. And it's why he got distracted. You know, it was the one time on that entire flight that she got the upper hand because he was interested in it. It was something that he did not get the knowledge of, and he wanted it. And she knew that. And yeah, I just thought all of that was just, as you said, you've got to tip your hat not only to Wes, not only to the actors, but the writer as well, because it stems from that script just being fucking immaculate, absolutely immaculate.
It's an absolute masterclass, I think, in terms of like getting across the most in a short period of time. And I think with this being, Carl Ellsworth is the writer. This was his first sort of film credit. So I feel like this was clearly so redefined. I think everything about this feels so refined. Like, we talk so much about how, oh yeah, we watched it, we covered a film, and it felt like someone filmed the first draft. That's something that just consistently happens over and over again, especially when you're dealing with a writer and director, you know, who are doing both, because they never have that person to step in and be like, yeah, you need to, you know, cut 20 minutes of this bullshit. But I feel like he was clearly sat on his own, just rewriting, and getting it tighter. And so when you get to the final product, there really is just no missing, you know, scenes in this film, in my opinion. But yeah, bringing it back to the start, like you say, when he first kind of, you know, is behind her and kind of, you know, has her back in the confrontation with the guy, and obviously leads to like the drink scene that you mentioned, of that. Like, I think this movie is what gave me a love of this type of film, which is that kind of the meet cute gone wrong, or the kind of, if it's too good to be true, it's definitely too good to be true.
Watching movies like Fresh last year, it is. Our love of those stemmed from this movie.
And it is crazy, because we talked about it then as well, but it's worth, like, reinforcing that point, because I've been wanting to see more films like this for so long. I think there's such a good, like, space in that, when you're vulnerable, when your guard is down because it's going so well and you want it to go so well, but then you find out that obviously that person's not who it seems. And yeah, like, I think Fresh so clearly kind of pulled from this, and even like the start of Barbarian, I think, is such like an interesting inverse of it, of like, this is what we're always expecting to happen, you know, like we've been tasked as viewers now that when it is the kind of charming guy who's got like an edge to him, he is always going to be the most fucked up person in the film. And I think these types of actors, the all three, you know, actors, Sebastian Stan, Cillian Murphy, and Bill Skarsgård, can play that role so goddamn well.
That's a fairly good list of, that's a fairly high caliber of actor,
isn't it? And it's insane, because I think they can play, let's say they could all just be in rom-coms forever if they wanted to be, but they all clearly have an edge to them, and they all want to do edgy shit, which just makes them all such great actors. But yeah, once we then get into, like, say, the plane, and it's just all going so well, and, you know, like, oh, we just happened to be sitting next to each other, isn't that a wild coincidence? And like I say, they've already set up so much. They've already set up like the rest of the characters that you're going to see on the plane, almost in like a Lost way as well, where like you've already had these little interactions with everyone that are clearly going to come back in interesting ways later on.
Like Lost or Final Destination, you know, something like that.
Definitely,
where
like, God.
Like, where it's like, oh, at
the same time as well, which is crazy.
Yeah, exactly, where it's just like, oh. You know, you get to see like 10 people walk on the plane, but two of them just stand out. Two of them are just a little bit more in focus, and you know that they're the two dudes that are going to give her unknowingly a pen later on in the movie. And it's just genius.
It's funny, just this just randomly popped into my head, because again, it's a good an example of just how amazingly tight this movie is. Like, a movie that I enjoyed this year and gave a positive review to was Cocaine Bear. But like, think about how they set up the characters in that movie, direct comparison to this film. That movie has like a 25 minute slow start where all of the characters individually have to set up and painstakingly slow to then bring them all together. And this movie's just like, nope, the first time you see them, they're all in the airport. And within 10 minutes, they're all on the plane, and they've already established who everyone is. It's just so beautiful. And then, like I say, once we get that turn, like, This to me is one of the things that I'll remember in like any film. Like I always remember specifically Cillian Murphy's delivery of that line when he says like, "My business is all about you." Like that to me is one of the iconic film lines, and I know it's not, but it just is in my head.
Because
I remember the feeling watching this film in the cinema when he said that, and I was like, you take a breath, and there's that slight beat in the music as well. Yeah. And you see, obviously, Rachel's incredible reaction to it, where it's kind of taken a moment being like, you know, is he joking? Are we still having a laugh, or is this going too far?
Yeah, you know, he made the joke of, am I stalking him, like, 2 minutes earlier. Is this another joke? And then...
I think it was before in the when they're having a drink as well. He mentions about killing his parents, which at the time was definitely sounded like a joke, you know. And she laughed and he laughed, and that sounds just, you know, like a joke someone would make. And then it's only when you kind of get more into it where you're like, oh shit, like he did kill his parents, like that wasn't a joke, because this guy is insane. And then like I say, from that point on, the tension is unreal when she's kind of like listening to him but looking around the plane and trying to figure out, what is my plan of action here? I have such a limited amount of options. And then obviously the way it unfolds with the phone calls and everything, like I say, with it cutting out during turbulence, is so genius. You know,
really,
and I love
just when it kicks off like early on with the woman with the bag and how he helps her because he's in charming mode and puts the bag up, and then just after he's revealed himself, she asks him to help again, and that's what causes all of the problems, because that's the old lady's in to then get in his seat. And it was just like, it's just so cleverly done.
Yeah, definitely. And I love how much he switches as well, because he goes from charming to then it's kind of sinister and cool, but in control. But then once he gets her to do what he wants, pretty much after the bathroom scene when he's leaving and he has that interaction with the stewardess, he becomes so cocky.
Yeah.
Like he feels like he's won at that point. He's smiling a lot more and he's a lot more relaxed with her. And that's obviously gets to the point of what you said, when his guard is down at the end, when he's finding the information that he wants. But like that was his biggest downfall, was that he thought he'd won. And of course he underestimated Lisa, because he was like, yep, you've done what I wanted you to do. You know,
you're just going to be quiet.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're a woman. You're just going to do what I say. You're going to sit there and take it, and I'm in control. And I think the moment that he got ahead of himself, he'd already lost. And she only needed that one moment to take advantage of that.
He said one thing that changed the tide of their whole dynamic, in my opinion, is when he said to Keiths.
Yeah.
And she's like, what? His family are there. And he's just like, collateral damage. And she's like... She had almost accepted writing off one person.
Yeah.
But when she was like, I can't just let a whole family get killed. And, you know, if he hadn't have given her that information, I don't know whether she would have had that fight. But, you know, she was almost sacrificing one person to save her dad. But when those numbers got bigger, I think that was when she really swayed and decided, no, I need to step up and do something about it.
Definitely. And I think that moment as well, like, again, trying to remember first time watching this film, I was so stunned when just out of nowhere she gets a pen and stabs him in the throat.
Oh, God, yeah.
Like that was unbelievably shocking. I was like, oh my God, you know, like I didn't know how this was going to go, but that was the last thing I thought was going to happen. And from that point, I feel like from the moment she stabs him in the neck until pretty much Lisa meets Cynthia, it's just chaos, like, for the next 15 minutes. It's so unbelievable, her kind of scrambling to get off the plane, everyone going, like, trying to help him, like, stealing the scarf off the woman. Obviously, the entire chase in the airport, which is, again, just completely, like, 24, you know, these, like, crowds and, like, security pointing at someone, and someone's, like, sat down and changed their shirt and wearing sunglasses and a hat. Like, just everything about
it. He sits down and does the little survey and then, like, fucks off. But also... the fact that, you know, she doesn't want security to find her right now because she's not worried about her own safety. If she gets caught by security, her dad dies.
Yeah.
So she's not only trying to escape. So she's not only trying to escape Jack, she's trying to escape the security as well. And again, just genius plot design, because if she's in that airport crowded away from him, she can just call for help. Like, she's fine. Like, she puts herself at risk to save her dad and to save the Keiths.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and go on.
No, I was just going to say, and then obviously leaving the airport and then getting the kind of the little mini finale, as it were, which I feel like my only negative is that it's over too soon. Because
yeah, but that's like this movie, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. But it is crazy because it's like, I feel like we've been so reinforced with Scream in particular that like the Scream movies typically have fairly long finales. And this doesn't, you know, it doesn't really have too much of a back and forth. Even though you do get like a phone call in the house and you get, I do think that there's two really good jump scares in this film.
There's one that always got me, like, for sure.
I think the headbutt is like insane because like when he headbutts her on the plane, you're not, it's fucking wild when that happens the first time, and it got me again this time. I was like, Jesus Christ, I forgot how just insane and in your face it is and how brash it is of him to do it. But then yeah, him behind the door is so good. Like obviously with her on the phone, like it's so amazingly well done. And again, like he, like Wes is such a master at this point that this is just child's play to him. Like he can do this in his sleep. Like, oh yeah, well there's a guy stalking a girl in a house, like I'm gonna be able to do that better than anyone else who's ever lived. So yeah, just to throw that in, like, oh no, I've already nailed all of these other things exceptionally well in this movie, but yeah, I'll just throw in a little mini, you know, slasher finale for you guys to have some fun.
There's even just like these little moments in it when, like, earlier in the movie they show her playing hockey in a picture. They reference that picture. She then finds the hockey stick and almost you can see the comfort in her face that she's found something that she feels comfortable with.
Yeah,
and then the way that she like twats that knife away to, like, you know, you know, just perfection. And it was just like, it's just little things like that where it's like you earn that moment by the little breadcrumbs that you put throughout this movie. And you've not given us a 3-hour fucking Lord of the Rings movie. You've given us a 70-minute movie with all these breadcrumbs in anyway. It's so good. But I do actually, because, you know, I've not seen this movie in a long time either, and when Jack gets shot, and he's like lying there, I thought there was like another Scream moment. Like in my head, I was like, oh, he comes back again, right? Or at least does like the Bagul and gets shot in the forehead.
Yeah.
Come on. And the fact that like he's lying there not dead at the end of this movie, you know, he is still like breathing when they cut away from him. And then we cut to the hotel. I'm like, Where's the 20 minutes like in that like destroyed hotel suite, like where he comes back again? Like it just felt like there was another sting in the tail and there wasn't. But I can't mark the movie down from it, but I just wishing that there was more because it was so exquisite.
Yeah, having Jack is like, he's got the scarf around his neck and he's obviously talking horrible, then he's like got a limp because of the bullet wound and he's just getting more and more like messed up going into the finale. And yeah, he ends up being like pushed off that, you know, that floor or something into the bay below. Like, yeah, it is weird that it does feel like that would be in there. But yeah, the movie just wraps up so quickly, and I do like the ending. Like, it's super cheesy, the whole like Lisa and Cynthia, but it's really fun, and it like really suits the humanity of those two characters, that like for them working in retail, like that's such a big win to just be like, no, we're not going to do things by the book, like we're just gonna I'm gonna support my friend over what I should do in this situation, which is say that the customer's always right. Like, no, you're not right, we're right. And like for them, that I think is the biggest win that they could possibly have.
You know, what we know Lisa had been through prior to this and how she was attacked. And in her job, she was still very submissive and she was in this role of power, but was always letting the customers walk all over her.
Yeah.
So to then like be like, no, fuck this. Like, I'm going to stand up for what I think's right and I'll deal with the consequences. Yeah, it's just so gold. Like, you know, watching this, I think, because, you know, there could easily be people listening to this podcast that have listened to the retrospective and have been big fans of Scream and Nightmare on Elm Street and been like, oh yeah, well, I like horror movies and I've seen People Under the Stairs and I've seen Hills of Eyes and I've seen these things. But like, I could easily see this being the hidden gem that so many people haven't seen. And that's really exciting because, you know, you might have got the gauge that we kind of like this movie from the conversation we've just had. But I really think this could be one that people haven't seen from Wes's catalog, and especially because it's not, you know, it's a balls to the wall thriller, as opposed to his all of his other movies, which are, you know, on the nose horror movies.
It is interesting that side of the debate, because I feel like for me, and going in, it felt like it was a unique selling point for this film to be like the master of horror is making a thriller. And to me, that was what was so exciting about it. And I wonder if kind of now that would be used almost as like a, oh yeah, it's good, but it's not a horror film. And I feel like that's almost like the worst take you could have on this film, because that's really missing the entire point of why Wes Craven made Red Eye in the first place. You know, he's made so many horror movies, and he made an exceptional horror movie after this. But the entire point was that, yeah, he's not going complete out of his wheelhouse. He's not making like a World War II drama, but he was making a thriller. Like it was purposely supposed to be different. It was never supposed to be gory or violent, or be a slasher or anything like that. It was supposed to be all about what are thriller elements. It's supposed to have tension, it's supposed to have plot, it's supposed to have character, and it nails all of those things so beautifully and so perfectly that as a thriller, I don't see how anyone could have a problem with this, especially with that runtime, which is just so outrageously ridiculous, and even more so now in a modern lens, where I just can't imagine what would essentially be the equivalent of this, of having a kind of a huge director. I mean, it's funny because like Ari Aster has now gone the opposite path, you know, where he's like, oh, my next movie, it's got the biggest actor in the world, it's not a horror film, and it's 3 hours long. And I love him for it, but like I can't imagine even
let's see it first.
Yeah, like I just can't imagine like a Jordan Peele or any of these big guys, you know, like Robert Eggers. I can't imagine them releasing a movie that short that is meaningful. Like there's a reason for it being that short. And you know, and arguably their movies could be shorter, even though I love them. Like it's really, there's something about it where, and I come back to the point I made at the start, like the stripping away the ego side, I think is fascinating. Because again, I do think that is a major issue. And everyone's allowed to have an ego. And I think a lot of amazing art comes from having an ego. But like, there are times when you need someone to just say, look, this is too much. Like this is just too much. You need to step back from your own work and realize that not everyone is living in your head. They need to have entertainment and enjoyment from this. And maybe you making this as 3 hours is great, but maybe releasing it as two is better for the world. And I feel like they don't always have that person saying that.
No, like, you know, you look at something like The Northman or Midsommar.
Yeah.
That, like, two of the favorite movies we've ever done for a podcast, but fuck, they're long. And you know, they are aware of how good they are, and they want you to smell that and suck that in and embrace it. They're like, do you know what? I've made a fucking masterpiece. You're going to sit there and just watch, like, beads of sweat drip off The Northman for a while, or watch you know, the camera spin around and a load of weird dances in Midsommar, like, you know, whatever they want to do, and yeah, that was still good, but this, you know, just shows that, like, yeah, just I'm just gonna make good shit, and I'm just gonna make it good, and yeah, like, wouldn't it be cool to linger longer in this scene? Yeah, it would be, but I just fucking gave you what I just delivered, you know, I'm not gonna hang around. I'm not gonna be proud of the moment with the old lady, and, you know, she could have been like asleep for 45 minutes in this movie, but it was like, no, I wanted to give you that gut punch of, is she dead? And then I wanted to give you the, no, she's not, she's okay, and then we're on to the next thing. And yeah, I think that's what the movie does so good, is that it just, like I said earlier on, it just does not waste a second of your time.
Absolutely. I think obviously as we're sort of coming to the end of the discussion, and then we'll get to ranking it. Like, I love that this episode has been talking all about the film. You know, like so many of these retrospectives, we've talked about the production hell and the back and forth, and here's what happened with this actor, and oh, you've got like the guy who's done the greatest special effects in werewolf history. Well, he got fired for no fucking reason. Like, there was so much bullshit, like, especially coming off the back of Cursed, which was like the king of bullshit, which is impressive. Like, to get this movie where none of that matters, we're not talking about the release of it or it being butchered by editing or anything. It's just, no, the movie just came out the way it should be, and it's fucking awesome. And we just get to talk about the film, which is what we want to do more than anything. So I just want to give a shout out to that as well, that it's made me love the movie even more, that there isn't a bunch of rubbish to talk about. It's just, no, the movie's just excellent. So that's all there is to talk about, is how excellent the film is.
Last thing, there's just so many good timings, because you think of like Michelle McAdams, and this was like just after Mean Girls and like fucking Notebook and stuff. What did I say, Michelle?
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I just looked it up. Yeah. And it is crazy that, yeah, her two big hits, in obviously what you mentioned, Mean Girls and The Notebook, was the year before. So they really did have two massive actors that were then, they were both peaking. They were both on a massive upwards trajectory. They both clearly believed in the project. And in my opinion, they both absolutely smashed it. I think this is a film that, were we doing the podcast in 2005, they would have easily won both the acting categories. It would have been a Quiet Place of 2005.
It really would have been. And I think, like, you know, but yeah, Wes doesn't get those wins. Like, yeah, he cast like a super young Johnny Depp, but he didn't cast Johnny Depp the movie after Pirates of the Caribbean. Sure. You know, like, these are two of the hottest actors in Hollywood at that time, and you know, for them to be in this movie, to not have production hell, to get a fucking 12 rating, like, you know, it's just, because this movie, like, I do think borderline, like, surprises me it's a 12, that, you know, we get, you know, there's assassination attempts, he's stabbed in the throat, there's the abuse that I mean, the character, we don't see it, but it's talked about a lot, the violence of the headbutt and a few other things, like, you know, I'm and being Wes Craven, I'm like, you know, I'm surprised he got that rating. Like, you know, this does feel like the one movie in his filmography that went right. Everything went right.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? Like, it's so awesome. I think it's great how, you know, this is in the tail end of his career. This is in the final three. And obviously we've already talked about and ranked Scream 4. But, like, I love that you might have thought he was coming to the end and kind of like, oh yeah, his best years were you know, in the 80s potentially. But, like, he really saved, in my opinion, two of his best films until right at the end. And I think that's so awesome as well. Like, it really fills me with joy that we obviously got Red Eye and Scream 4. Because if it was that kind of like, oh yeah, we got Vampire in Brooklyn and we got Cursed and that was it, like, it would have been so sad if we hadn't got these two massive, and in my opinion, like you say, two of my favorites as well. But yeah, speaking of which, we've got to rank this film. So yeah, we've got 17 films on the list currently. I guess, yeah, we'll go over the whole thing because it's fun, but I feel like there's a fairly, you know, this is going to be in a certain section of the list, shall we say. But yeah, kicking things off with our current number one is A Nightmare on Elm Street, followed by Scream, then Scream 4, then The Hills of Eyes Part 2, and The Hills of Eyes, the first one, rounded out the top five. Then we get to Scream 2, Wes Craven's New Nightmare, Shocker, Last House on the Left, and Scream 3, rounding out the top 10. And then our bottom seven currently are The People Under the Stairs, Cursed, which I can't believe Cursed is that high, but I guess we must have not liked the other stuff. Swamp Thing below that. And then, yeah, bottom four, which are very forgettable, in Deadly Blessing, Deadly Friend, Vampire in Brooklyn, and The Serpent and the Rainbow. So yeah, that is the list currently, which of course can always change at any given point. Which, yeah, I don't know. I feel like Cursed is too high, but that's another discussion. Did we like Parts of Cursed? I can't even remember.
I did.
Yeah, well, maybe that was you. Yeah, I just can't. All I can remember is talking about the production hell, but maybe the movie wasn't as bad as those other ones.
Yeah,
but
we're talking about number 12. Like, it had its moments. Like, yeah, like. Yeah, if it is in the top half, then it's got problems. But, yeah. No, I mean, this one's a headache, really, because we start to get into that elite tier, and it's like, man, these movies are all so good.
Mm.
And, yeah, it does start to hurt.
Yeah, it's really difficult for us. You know, this is all about our favorites. Hence why The Hills of Eyes Part 2 is at number 4. I think with The Hills of Eyes being at number 5, for me, this is definitely better than that. Or is at least my favorite. I don't know if you agree or disagree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking basically, yeah, work the way up the top half. And so what's below The Hills of Eyes?
So Scream 2 is 6 and New Nightmare is 7.
Yeah. I mean, fuck, they're all bangers, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, even Shocker at 8. Like, I feel like, yeah, I mean, the top 7 is very, very strong.
Hang on, what Scream movie was above New Nightmare?
2.
Yeah, I mean, even that, I'm like, I really like New Nightmare.
Yeah.
Like... Yeah, there's a battle to be had there at some point, I feel.
Yeah, maybe. But, oh, Scream 2 is so good, though.
Yeah, it's crazy, but this is one that, yeah, pound for pound with nostalgia and how much I love it as well. Like, this definitely does hang with the real elite, and it is a case of, could it possibly overrule Hills of Eyes Part 2? I really don't think so, because the nostalgia just is too insane. And I'm like, you know, does it overtake Hills of Eyes Part 1? And I think, you know, it's really close for me. And I think just watching Red Eye, I feel like it has the edge, and I think that's probably where it should be for now. And then kind of see how, when the dust settles, because, you know, you're on the high of the movie, aren't you, after watching it?
Wait, so just to clarify, do you think it would be number 5 below Eyes Part 2 but above Hills 1? Right.
Yeah.
I disagree. We're definitely in agreement in terms of the top. I think I definitely think it's worth, like, you know, this isn't one that's like, oh yeah, it's nowhere near those. Like, it is, we're talking about a movie that's that good to me. That, like, yeah, it's not Nightmare on Elm Street and it's not Scream, but it is amazing. And I think I just love Scream 4 so much, maybe in like a ridiculous way, how much I love that film. Because, like, on any given day, if someone was like, yeah, Red Eye's better, I wouldn't necessarily want to fight that. But, like, I have such an unbelievable love for Scream 4. You know, it might be like my favorite horror sequel ever. Like, I just really love that film. But then, yeah, looking at the rest, for me, this is definitely better than The Hills of Eyes 1, which I do love. And then, yeah, I'm looking at Part 2, which is obviously so important to us. And I'm so happy that it's as high as it is. But I do think, for me, Red Eye has both. It's obviously not as nostalgic as Hills of Eyes Part 2, because that was so seminal for us growing up. But I just have such a good early memory of watching Red Eye at the cinema. And I do tie a lot of my love of seeing films at the cinema with Red Eye specifically, along with, like I mentioned, Hostel and Resident Evil. And so maybe it's not just singular to Red Eye. It's kind of like those early years, and it's just one of, you know, a few. But rewatching it now, I think it's flawless. Like, I just don't think it has any problems at all. So for me, it would be number 4. I would have it above Hills of Eyes Part 2 and just a hair below Scream 4. That would be, that would one be of my them,
I think for me, like, when you talk about, I think it's like, it's silly, because I think, just with Hills of Eyes Part 2, if we hadn't have had our moments with that and discovering it the way we discovered it and everything else, I don't think we would still be trying to discover horror movies today.
Definitely.
And I think that's why it's so seminal for me. And it's like, yeah, if we compare the two, if we compare The Hills of Eyes Part 2 to any of these movies in a complete, if you compared it to like a New Nightmare in terms of like, how the script and the execution and the way things are and loads of things, then it could easily start to fall down that list. But I just think for us, it's so important, and it's and I just can't ever break away from that. And I love everything about that movie.
Oh yeah, I completely agree. Like,
and I think as well, the fact that for us that was The Hills of Ice Part One as well.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, really. The Hills of Ice Part 1 is only that high because of how much we love it in Part 2.
I know, it's like it's almost shocking that it's still that high, yeah. Which is funny.
Yeah, because it doesn't even, you know, even to this day, it doesn't really feel like a movie to me. You know, it's almost like the fucking trailers in between Grindhouse, where I'm like, that's basically what The Hills of Ice is. Like, it's just the little segments for Hills of Ice Part 2.
Whilst I agree, that is because our brains are broken, because
I know, but this is our broken
brain. Oh, I know, but like, I like The Hills of Ice a lot. I think it has a lot of merit. But I do agree with you, and I think, yeah, in terms of, like, it, for me, I guess it all just depends on how much you want to put on Part 2, because,
yeah,
like, why is it below Scream 4 in that case? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, at what point does it, at what point does nostalgia, I feel like the top two is certain that, like, you can't change those top two.
Yeah, I mean, the problem, I think the thing is, I would put an argument for it to be third. I really would, man.
You're insane.
Mate, because that movie was just something else to us, and I think that's the thing, is like, yeah, if we're going to talk, like, with the normal weekly podcast hat on, I think, you know, Red Eye is a better pound for pound movie than Part 2. Scream 4 is a better pound for pound movie than Part 2. But when you get into just our love of it and the nostalgia and the importance of it, I think that's when we have to skew it in that way. So yeah, I'd sandwich Red Eye between those two. It's a beautiful place to be.
Yeah, it is. Like, I have all these films. I only have one of these posters on my wall currently, which is The Hills of Ice Part 2. So I adore this film, obviously. I'm willing to concede and be the bigger man here, and take the moral high ground. And
well, I think that's what I did with you know, letting you keep Scream form there. And don't start this fucking moral high ground shit with me. Like, you know, oh yeah, I don't love Hills of Ice. You can die on that hill. You die on the Hills of Ice Part 2 hill.
I love that. In the same breath I said that, let me just say it again. I have a poster of this film on my wall right now.
Well, don't go moral fiber in me, okay?
But also, I'll let you have your little film, all right? Sorry, yeah. Red Eye, you're only number 5, even though, arguably, that was the most positive review we've ever given a film.
Yeah, apart from the 4 films above it. That's the thing, you know, Wes is a joke.
Yeah, true. Yeah, and like, the free blow it.
Like, don't get me wrong, like, when you start to go to those bottom 3 or 4 movies, they're rough movies, but my God, like, when we're done and we've got a top 10...
Well, that's the thing, we have a movie right now that is not in his top 10, which I think is fantastic, which is Scream 3. Like, yeah. It's not in the top 10 right now.
Yeah, that's carnage.
And, like, yeah, it's crazy. But, yeah, that is the list. So, yeah, obviously, right now, currently, it's Nightmare on Elm Street still holding on to that number 1 spot. Number 2, Scream. Number 3, Scream 4. Number 4, The Hills of Ice Part 2. And a brand new number 5 is Red Eye. Yeah, such a sensational film. I'm so happy seeing it on the list. I'm so happy seeing it amongst such esteemed, you know, films.
Sure.
And yeah, looking at this list, it definitely feels like our list, which I love about this as well.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, we have our, you know, our own personal favorites. And I think there's the undisputed 2 at the top, but, like, those next 3 in whatever order, I'm so happy it's those 3. Yeah. Because the amount of times just in reference we talk about either Scream 4 or Hills of Ice Part 2 or Red Eye, for completely different reasons as well. Like, those 3 films to me feel like from completely different eras of my life when I watched them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because they are,
yeah,
and but they're all Wes,
exactly, you know, he is that,
and that's what makes me sad that, like, you know, we would have been talking Wes movies on this podcast. Mm. You know, or we could have, and what a joy that would have been, because look at these movies towards the end of the man's filmography. It wasn't like he was slowing up.
No.
You know, literally his, well, penultimate that we're going to be talking about, but, you know, second or, you know, third from last movie, and it's in our top 5.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, you look at his
and the other one is above it.
Yeah,
it's third.
Exactly. Third and fifth on our list is his second and third, with one in between, like last films, which is just crazy to think about. It's awesome. But that is the list so far. Obviously, we only have one more new film to add to the list, which is, of course, My Soul to Take.
It's gonna be fun.
Yeah, like I think I've seen this movie once. I don't remember anything about it, so it's basically gonna be like a fresh watch for me. Because it came out like just before Scream, didn't it? Scream 4.
Yeah, like crazy.
Yeah, so close it was. I remember it being so weird because I think you just had like turned up and I was like, oh yeah, I'm really excited for Scream 4. And you was like, yeah, I've got this new Wes movie on DVD. It's like, what the hell's that? Because that was still at the time when obviously you weren't like finding out about everything on the internet constantly. But yeah, it was I'm looking forward to it. And then yeah, we've kind of floated some ideas. That's for in the future. Maybe we'll do like a finale, a sort of head-to-head of the big two at the end.
Yeah, well, I really feel like that's where my mindset's at, that I want to see those two movies again, like to just really decide the number one.
And then we've got to do Scream 4 versus Hills of Eyes Part 2 versus Red Eye.
No, we'll go on to the Terminator 2.
What a week that would be, though. My God. That'd be sensational. I might just do that now. That's sensational. And then obviously, we've even talked about, there is TV films in the future. I have not done any research about if they're even possible to find anymore.
Yeah, you'll find them.
But I would love to kind of do that. Because that is wild. If they are, 80-minute films that are just out there that Wes Craven directed. It feels wild to not watch them, even though they aren't like his proper films. That is an interesting one for the future. For now, that was our discussion on Red Eye. We will take a quick break and we will be right back. So yeah, kind of fitting with the theme of this week, I did watch a movie over the weekend that I'll just briefly mention, which we've talked about obviously this year. We will continue to talk about this year, so I won't go into it too much. But it was my first rewatch of Scream 6.
Nice.
Obviously, I'd said recently that it was my favorite horror movie of the year currently, and it absolutely still is. I think the one thing I will say is we've talked a lot about when it comes to Scream, you have your first watch and then you have every other watch after that, which is your rewatch, knowing who the killers are. So it's kind of hard to give your first proper judgment because it's almost like that's not what your real watch of Scream is not having the knowledge. Every other viewing you'll ever have for the rest of your life, you'll have that knowledge. So I'm always excited to rewatch it, like I did with last year's one. And my opinion didn't really change. And I will say, it doesn't change anything dramatically because I still love the film. But I do think I probably like it a bit more because I do think that they do a good job of setting up the killers in this one, obviously without going into it. And I do like a lot of some of the dialogue and things now that you have that knowledge and everything has like double meaning, I think there are some really clever stuff in there. So I loved it. It's such a phenomenal movie. Like that ladder sequence that we talked about is still one of the best things. Yeah. That I've seen in a film this year. So well crafted, let alone the intro, which is so good again on rewatch. Like I was just grinning from ear to ear the moment I put it on and that intro started. And then it all came flooding back to me how many scenes I loved, where I was like, oh, I can't wait for the ladder scene. I can't wait for the subway scene. I can't wait for the cinema scene. Like, there's just so much good shit in this film. And it's just so fun. But yeah, I loved watching Scream 6 again. It's remarkable how astonishingly good this movie is. And it's just great to have a franchise entry that's that good. Especially with one that we love as much as Scream, as we've just talked about in our list. So
I think that's it. Like post Wes, the fact that we're still getting banger Scream movies is something that I never thought would happen.
No, and I really don't want to take this for granted. Even last year's one, you know, which I had mild disappointment about, but I was like, it was up for our best sequel. It was in our top 10. I would say I enjoyed it more than I didn't enjoy it. But it's easy to be focused on those negatives and be like, it didn't do this, it didn't do that. But you just have to think about the state of other franchises. And you just have to do those direct comparisons, whether it was Hellraiser for 20 years, whether it's the last three Saw movies, whether it's the last three Halloween movies. Yeah, like, there's so much, like, so many of the Texas Chainsaw sequels. There's so much shit to these franchises that don't deserve it. And I'm so happy that Scream has been always fantastic now. There, like I say, we've said it before and we'll say it again, that there's six fantastic Scream films. You can have your favorites. We obviously have ours. But I think that there's no doubt to me that none of them are bad. And I think that's what's so strong about it. And it's so awesome that with six installments after this long, it's still the case. And yeah, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with the future right now, which is a weird spot to be in right now, given how much, you know, financially successful the movie was, and it being awesome. That, like, obviously the directors are doing other stuff right now. So it will be a case of, will they step away and let someone else do it? In which case, you know, very much good luck. Or will they just say, you know what, we did two and that's it? Like, I would love to see them do that personally. Because I, as I said before, I think Scream 6 is about as perfect as a modern day sequel you could have for Scream. And I always like when Scream is a reflection of the current horror genre. So I don't want it to be like an annualized or every other, you know, thing right now. Even though we have such a good cast that it'd be great to see them in more films. I don't know. I'd be happy either way. If they said, yeah, we're doing Scream 7, great. But if they said, you know what, we're going to put it on ice and maybe we'll bring it back in 6 or 7 years, I'd also be perfectly happy with that right now, because we've just got fantastic movies to watch in the meantime. What about you? Are you leaning to more towards one more than the other? Like, would you be? Are you like so eager for more Scream? Or would you be like, nah, it's fine if they just leave it?
I just wouldn't want them to leave it right now because it's so good.
Yeah.
But you know, the second it gets bad, then you know it's, you know, we're, you know, you're playing blackjack, aren't you?
Yeah.
Once you bust, you bust.
That's a good point.
But I do, you know, I am very excited for more right now.
Yeah, it's so hard to walk away when it's this good, isn't it? Like, that would be such a bold decision to do so well with the two films. But obviously, for me personally, I think Scream 6 is superior. And to then walk away and be like, yeah, we're done. We're just doing two. Especially, like, I don't know about certain contract situations, but, like, General Tager is becoming so huge now. And even getting her for the first Scream, she wasn't as big. And it's crazy to think about that now, because that was only last year. But, like, even having her in the movie is so important to them as well. It's crazy, whatever they do.
Well, you know, it does feel like they've got a Courtney Cox
fan,
you know, like, it's just mega star that's, like, in this movie. And, you know, and I think as well, like the filmmakers just, I think they've really found their rhythm with this second one. You know, the first one was a lot of homage and a lot of not wanting to tread on Wes's toes, which was very respectful and the right thing to do. But this one, they could just have that freedom a lot more. They'd made a Scream movie, so they're not remaking Wes's movie. They're making a sequel to their own Scream movie. And that just, it felt more like shoes that fit, and I'd like them to continue walking in them.
Yeah, definitely.
I was just gonna, I briefly mentioned it earlier on actually, that I've just started rewatching Midnight Mass, and I do find it funny how we spoke about how filmmakers sometimes, you know, don't have the balls to just make something shorter and make, you know, they do make things last. And I, you know, was calling out, you know, things like that I love, like Midsommar and Northman, etc. And like watching Midnight Mass, like it takes the piss how long it is, each episode, but it's just, it's exquisite. And it is just, it's just the this arrogance of knowing that you're doing something so good. So it's like, yeah, I'm just gonna have the priest like deliver a fucking sermon for like 45 minutes of an episode and you're gonna love it. And it's like, why am I gonna love it? I'm not religious, but it proper just works. And I think rewatching this show, knowing how a lot more how personal it was to Flanagan, and how he is an atheist that had a lot of religious input into his life and has chosen that path. I think, you know, it really does come through, and I think kind of seeing him embody that and kind of put it in a way that isn't, I personally don't find disrespectful. In fact, I find it the complete opposite, that these people are, you know, trying to show the good and bad of all aspects of it. I just thought it was, it just speaks to me, man, like rewatching it just on so many things. And I haven't got to the emotional shit yet. Like that's when it really spoke to me before, but it's already speaking to me again. And I'm just like, it really is a special show where it's like, you know, we did tip our hat to Wes saying like, yeah, you know, don't take the piss with people's time. And I absolutely agree that should be the rule. And this should be the exception, that sometimes, you know, motherfuckers deserve to be a bit arrogant and to just really, you know, really stretch it out. And Flanagan earned that and then delivered with Midnight Mass.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree. And, like, I think my overall point with that as well was, like, not everything has to be that. I think so many...
Yeah, exactly. Earn it. Make it the exception, not the
rule. Yeah, because so many directors, they just want to do that with every project. And I think this is clearly, I think, the most defining Flanagan project that will ever exist. Yeah. Because it was basically his life story, you know, with his, you know, with his struggles with alcohol in there as well. And I would love to rewatch Midnight Mass. I just don't know if I'm ever going to be like emotionally capable of it. Because even just thinking about it, there is a lot to love in it. There is a lot of joy in that show, but there's so much sadness in it as well. It is just an emotionally draining. The highs are high, but the lows are very low as well. And I just don't know if I'm ever going to be in that place for, like, say, what is a, I don't know, 10-hour commitment or something like that, that is 100% worth it. And I do think it doesn't probably get talked about enough by us or by anyone, by everyone.
Because it's too much. It's too good at what it's trying to do.
Yeah, like we've just been so spoiled with TV in recent years. Like, yeah. Obviously, our personal, like I've said before, like my favorite TV show since my favorite TV show of all time, Lost, is The Last of Us. But like, even putting that to a side, with obviously Black Mirror now coming back and the two Flanagan shows, and even Stranger Things, which is it's a different thing, but it's just pure joy and entertainment. You know, it's not like this art weighty arty thing like a lot of these other shows are. But it's not trying to be that, and I do appreciate that in its own bubble, because Black Mirror typically has something to say whilst being entertaining. The Last of Us is purely about like its message a lot of the times, and so is the Flanagan stuff. Whereas I do really like that Stranger Things isn't kind of doing that. It is just like, we just want to have fun. And I'm definitely in a place where I want more things to just give me fun. Hence why talking about Red Eye, you know, in terms of like, Wes wasn't trying to have a long drawn out message in this film, even though there is messages in it. Like, it's just trying to be fun and entertaining, and I feel like too many things in entertainment forget that they're supposed to be entertaining first. So yeah, and that is as well, like Midnight Mass is ridiculously entertaining, god, it's so good. But yeah, I don't know if I'm ever going to be in a place to rewatch it. Was it 2020 when it came out?
Is it 2020 or 21?
I can't remember. Because I'm like, it's not been too long. And, you know, it's coming up to 3 years if it was 2020.
Yeah, I feel like it might have been 21, but...
God, was it that recent?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's difficult.
I feel like it was fairly recent, but... I don't know. Things just blend in at this point.
Yeah, they really do. But yeah, it's such a good show. Like, that everyone...
Yeah, 21.
Right, yeah. So yeah, I mean, that's a bold move, rewatching that within 2 years, because I'm definitely not ready for it yet. Like, I will be one day, but I'm not there right now. I hope you have a blast with it. Or you're probably not a blast, I don't even know. I hope you get what you want from it.
Well, it's funny because, like, this episode right now is, like, just after, like, the miracles start to happen and things are all good and people who have sore backs can now dance and they don't need to wear glasses and people can walk again and it's, like, all happy. And I'm like, oh, no, don't feel happy because I know what's going to happen, but damn it, I feel happy right now.
You see, all I can remember is just, like, the opening scene of Midnight Mass.
Yeah, my God.
And I remember just being, like... I felt like I'd been punched in the face immediately. And mm-hmm. and then when it was like, oh, this is the lead character of the show. Like, yeah. holy shit. Like, how are you going to pull this off, Flanagan? And, like, he somehow does. But I just couldn't believe that that's how he opened a TV show. It was like, yeah, we're probably going to present to you arguably one of the worst traits that you can put in a person in the opening scene. And it was just unbelievable. Like, this guy is on a different level. And, yeah, I'm so happy that he's returning to film. Because, yeah, I just don't think... I know he did it, like he's done it twice, but I just don't know how he can possibly do it again in the TV world. You know, he did Hill House, he did Midnight Mass, and those are two very different things. And obviously Midnight Mass was something that was on the back burner for so long, but I just don't see how he could come up with something brand new that tops those two shows. But maybe he could. That's why I want to see films, definitely. Because he has so much unfinished business in film. You know, he's been so
He's not... Yeah, he's not given his mark
yet in the world, I don't think. Yeah, which is so exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, if he makes a TV show better than Midnight Mass, then the world's not ready for that, you know. Whereas, yeah, I don't think he's hit his peak yet with the film.
No, absolutely.
You know, Dr. Sleep just had... we've been there with that.
Yeah, he's done so many films that we loved, like... obviously Hush, what's the other one? Gerald's Game, which is like, yeah, is so good. I've been wanting to rewatch that since I saw it and still haven't.
That movie's amazing.
Yeah, it's so good. I just love talking about Flanagan. He's another one of those guys, really. It's so fascinating, this kind of through line, the way this conversation's gone from talking about a Wes Craven movie to then talking about the continuation and the legacy of a franchise, in Scream.
Yeah.
To then, to me, one of those great auteurs that arguably the closest we've got to a modern-day Wes is Mike Flanagan, in my opinion, because of how unbelievably prestigious so many of his hits are. It's outrageous. Like, you just forget that a movie like Hush he did, you know, or Gerald's Game, like you say, that he's just, because there's so much that your mind immediately goes to Hill House and Midnight Mass.
Well, and that's why it gets to the point that, like, something like Dr. Sleep, you focus on the negative because you have to bump it down the list, because you're like, well, it's not going to be as good as the top two. So then you've got to argue for everything else. And that's the exact conversation we've just had with Wes. You know, most people, Dr. Sleep would be their masterpiece.
Yeah, well, like, and I think Dr. Sleep for us was the number four movie that year, which is, not only is that good on its own, but 2019 had Us and Midsommar and Free from Hell. Those were the three that were above it. Yeah. So it's like most years he would have easily been in a shout to winning it.
That Dr. Sleep 100%. Like, is in the conversation. It's first or second in other years that we've done.
Definitely. Yeah, I even looked to last year and I'm like, oh, it would have been in that conversation. Like, the conversation of the two films, it was between X and Northman. Dr. Sleep would absolutely have been in that conversation. Like, so yeah, it's fantastic. But yeah, that is it for another episode. Thanks for listening, as always, and we'll see you again very soon.
See you later, everyone. I never could, and how could I start now?